But first, to a foreign affair.
To walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Tommy said, Mr. President, you're wrong. Now that takes a lot of guts.
I'm for peace and quiet, Mr. Lute. It's why I came to the UN. Quiet diplomacy.
Yes, our monthly discussion, identified by that clever jingle that RN producer Belinda Summer introduced last year in our effort to introduce a little more humour and wry comment into this discussion, that we'd like to really be a sort of water cooler discussion at the end of each month, where we invite three guests to nominate what they see as an important event that had made an improvement in foreign relations or set us back. It's always a lively discussion, which is our aim, that everyone can join in, and I'm happy to say we're going to continue it this year. At the end of January 2018, the big topics of discussion were reforms in Saudi Arabia and what they meant. Fascinating, considering that that was a topic that was discussed more and more as the year went by. Diplomatic advances on the Korean Peninsula and Japan, and Vladimir Putin's control over Russian history. My guests were Kyle Wilson, a visiting fellow at the Centre for European Studies at the ANU, Anthony Bubalo, who was at the time Deputy Director and Research Director at the Lowy Institute, now a principal at NAUS Consultancy Group, and Lauren Richardson, the Director of Studies at the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy at the ANU, and I welcomed them all.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Lauren, we spent a lot of time talking about North Korea last year, but you see certainly some positive developments this month with the North and the South agreeing to march together in the Seoul Winter Olympics. This is a meeting between representatives of the two countries.
Until recently, the North Koreans have refused to even pick up the phone when the South Koreans tried to place calls at the border hotline. So it was significant to see Ri Son-gwon, the man in charge of inter-Korean relations for the government in the north, stepping over the border into the southern side of what's known as the Truce Village at Panmunjom, leading a five-member team of high-ranking officials into a meeting with his South Korean counterpart.
Our talks resume after North and South Korean ties have been severed for a long time, but I believe the first step is half the journey.
We came to this meeting today with a serious and sincere attitude and with the thought of giving our brethren, who have high hopes for this dialogue, invaluable results as the first present of the year.
Lauren, we've just heard Michael Pembroke believe that this won't be a major step forward. What do you think?
Well, I think that it's a really important step in the sense that it's the very first sign of de-escalation that we've seen of the nuclear crisis that has just been very steadily mounting over the last year. And it's just become worse and worse with increases in the frequency of North Korea's ballistic missile test, escalating rhetoric between Trump and Kim Jong-un. And we've also seen, in retaliation to North Korea's tests, escalating military drills between the US and South Korea, and also trilateral drills with Japan, which have just sort of added fuel to the fire. So this is the very first step, I think, of de-escalation. It's not going to result in a complete de-escalation of this crisis. I mean, North Korea is going to continue to pursue its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program, but this is the first indication that it may be paused for a while and that North Korea is now communicating with South Korea.
Dare I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes,
because
sure.
It was the fact that we heard in the wider world that there were people who could talk to each other, I suppose.
Right.
That's what hit me, as you thought, well, at least that's something. And you know, whether you're going to have this drift into the security establishment, if I suppose, is a moot point, Anthony Bubalo. I mean, they could be completely, I mean, obviously they're separate groups, but it's just that scepticism about whether anybody in the two Koreas can talk to each other.
Well, I mean, look, as Lauren says, it's obviously a positive sign. The question is, does it end there, or does it then, as you say, extend into the kind of to the harder security issues?
And do you, Kyle, who sort of explored this northern part of the world a great deal, do you sense that there's movement that matters, or is it terribly peripheral?
I guess my reaction would be, Geraldine, what other option is there? You know, you had James Clapper here last year. he made the point very clearly.
Former head of national security in the UK, US.
In the US, that, you know, that there are no military options. There are simply none. Well, whether the shambling figure in the White House knows that, I don't know. But it just seems to me you can say the only hope is to engage with the hope of moderating North Korean behaviour. So therefore, you know, any contact like this, I think Lauren is absolutely right. I have no pretensions to knowledge of Korea that, you know, this is, well, this is much to be welcomed.
Well, in fact, Lauren, it's also true, isn't it, that South Korea has made quite a significant decision that it will not be trying to renegotiate the agreement with Japan about the comfort women, the terrible story of the comfort women from World War II, which has caused great tension between the two countries. So that's interesting developments, really.
Yeah, and this is not totally unrelated to the North Korean nuclear crisis. I mean, these history problems that have been going on between Japan and South Korea for ever since the colonial period ended, they show a tendency to sort of subside whenever the security issues increase in the region. I mean, the deal, the comfort women issue, it's not completely resolved because the South Korean president, the committee he set up to look into this accord, signed under the previous administration, he's basically said, okay, it's flawed, it's not perfect, but I really don't think he's going to pursue that with Japan right now. And also Japan, for its part, it's not really happy with the result of that examination into the accord, but Japan has just announced that President Abe is going to be attending the Winter Olympics,
right,
the opening ceremony. So that's really kind of an overture.
Something.
And I think this is just, I mean, they're not trying to say that, okay, this is because of the comfort women issue or, you know, it's done, but it's really just a show of, you know, support for South Korea to show that they're on the same page with this North Korean nuclear crisis and the US as well. I think that's what's behind this.
Is it possible, of course, Lauren, and then we'll leave it, that all of the drama around this ballistic missile crisis has actually shocked people into reaching out so that diplomacy is at work? I wonder if that is what is underway that we're watching.
I really think it has, especially for Japan and South Korea, who are really very close to North Korea. And we've seen in the past year missiles flying through Japanese airspace. So it's really brought the threat very close to both of these countries. And I think they've really had to put some of these history problems aside.
Well, we'll see what history problems can be laid aside in Saudi Arabia, which I also detect is going to be in the news a lot this year for both reforms and other activities. There were some considerable changes to Saudi Arabian society. For instance, the activities women can take part in, we take for granted driving a car and going to a football game without male guardianship, but not so in Saudi. This is how Al Jazeera reported it last week.
A few small steps for one female football fan, a giant leap for Saudi Arabia. For the first time, the deeply conservative Muslim kingdom has allowed women to spectate at a soccer match. The groundbreaking game in Jeddah comes as part of an easing of strict rules on gender separation. Women attending a mixed public sporting event is one of many recent reforms spearheaded by young Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. On Thursday, Jeddah held Saudi Arabia's first car exhibition aimed at women, a few months after the country announced it would grant them the right to drive.
So Anthony Bubalo, who's thoroughly absorbed himself in this area, is this a major effort by this young prince to change the society or
it's
not
part,
quite that?
It's part of a major effort to change society. There are different aspects to this. Ever since his father came to the throne and MBS, his son,
Mohammed bin Salman,
MBS as we know him in the trade, as he's been put in charge of really spearheading these reforms, the kind of moves on to change male guardianship, to allow women to drive, are part of a broader package of reforms, including significant economic reforms. What's also been really striking is how quickly he's moving. I mean, you know, I lived in Saudi Arabia for a couple of years. Things tend to move very slowly in a very conservative society. And what struck people is how dramatic some of the things that MBS has done are and how quickly he's moving. It's significant for a few reasons. First of all, it's significant because whilst we tend to focus on the geopolitics of the Middle East all the time, what we tend to miss are the domestic issues. And I think it's these domestic issues that are really going to determine the fate of the region. It's not going to be the proxy wars that Saudi Arabia and Iran are fighting in the region. It's going to be the race between those two countries to reform their societies. Because what this tells you too is that, these leaders are acutely conscious that the issues that caused the uprisings in 2011 in the Arab world and in 2009 in Iran have not gone away. The systems that, these rulers preside over are broken and they're decaying, and they have to fix them. So the question is, what's the best way to do that?
And how do they not activate a reaction that then topples them?
Exactly. Now, the women thing is interesting because on the one hand, it does reflect the activism of many Saudi women, much of it unnoticed in the West, well over a decade, to get the right to drive and to end male guardianship. So it's definitely a reflection of that. But also, I think, reflects a fundamental realization of the economic and intellectual potential in Saudi women that is going unutilized. You know, generally, women, not just in Saudi Arabia, but across the Middle East, are outpacing men in education. There is this enormous productive capacity that's simply not being utilized. I mean, the World Bank and the IMF have done studies in the past where they've shown that there can be incredible improvements to the GDP of many countries simply by getting more women to work.
Right.
So there is also an economic imperative here too.
So I had somebody emailed me just this week, knowing I was back on air, and said, don't be taken in by all of this story. He says, as MBS says, I'm for moderate Islam, etc. But in fact, he's still very much dealing with the very conservative clerics and has shown no serious effort to change their modus operandi. So what do I make of that?
We are right to be skeptical about a lot of these reforms. Some of them are a bit of a marketing exercise to change Saudi Arabia's image internationally. Some of them are not particularly well thought through and may not actually work. They have also been accompanied by an incredible and unprecedented centralization of power into Mohammed bin Salman's hands that saw him at the end of last year
imprison
a whole bunch of
in the
Ritz-Carlton.
Yes, that's right.
Imprison a whole bunch of his critics and rivals. That was preceded by a wider kind of crackdown. So there are darker sides to this as well. I think specifically on this whole question of whether he can moderate Saudi Islam, I think we are right to be skeptical. The purest, rigid form of Saudi Islam, that is the state creed in Saudi Arabia, is foundational to the state. This is not something that was implemented 30 years ago, and it will be something that's difficult to change overnight.
This is Wahhabism. So, so that whole argument of church and state, they haven't really had that.
They haven't had that, but it's not really about an argument over church and state. What it is the Saudi royal family, one of its pillars of its legitimacy is the backing of the Saudi conservative religious establishment. That hasn't really changed. Whilst Mohammed bin Salman has lifted some of the kind of religious restrictions that crimp social life, so, you know, he's forced the religious police to back off a bit and let young kids have a bit more fun, that fundamental relationship between the royal family and the religious establishment hasn't changed.
Pretty tough.
And will take time to change.
This is a small, because I had to travel back from holidays through Dubai, and I discovered they're bringing in taxation there. Personal taxation is being introduced into the United Arab Emirates. Is there personal taxation in the Saudi kingdom, do you know?
Well, so basically in the past, the Saudi social welfare state was very generous. There was low levels or no levels of taxation. So what the Saudis, you know, are doing is they are introducing some forms of taxation, but more importantly, they are reducing some of the kind of social subsidies that they provide people. And the problem they face...
This is huge, actually.
It's enormous. And the problems they face are the same around the region, is that the region's rulers can no longer afford these social welfare states. Why that's significant is that was basically the way they purchased the loyalty of their citizens. And if you can't get it by paying people, you have to get it in other ways. And one of those ways has to be giving people a say in the way that they're ruled.
Wow. Okay, well, look, there was a very important anniversary last year, that of the 1917 Russian Revolution, that we covered quite extensively on RN. We looked at why it was so troublesome, for instance, for Vladimir Putin to commemorate it in true Russian fashion. But an anniversary that was marked at the very end of last month was the 100 years since the establishment of the secret police, the Cheka, on the 20th of December 1917. Here's just a little history lesson delivered by the History Pod Group. It really does bring it home what we're dealing with.
On the 20th of December 1917, the Russian Bolshevik secret police, known as the Cheka, was established. Led by Felix Dzerzhinsky, the organization's name was derived from the Russian initials for its original full title, the All-Russian Emergency Commission for Combating Counter-Revolution and Sabotage. Hundreds of Cheka committees were formed across Russia, who went on to arrest, torture, or execute many thousands of dissidents, deserters, and other enemies of the state, before Cheka was dissolved on February the 6th, 1922.
Now, Kyle Wilson, would a reasonable analogy be Putin deciding to celebrate the Cheka? Would it be like the Germans celebrating the setting up of the Gestapo?
I'm a little cheery about, you know, drawing a parallel like that, you know, a parallel between Nazi Germany.
But it does sort of bring it. It is pretty vivid as a thought, isn't it?
Oh, it's highly vivid. But you see, I may want to go to Russia again one day, and if I compare the FSB to the Gestapo, I may not get a visa. So I'll be a little careful about that. I mean, it seems to me that it is quite remarkable that the choice was made by Putin in effect to ignore an event which for 70 years, 3.5 generations of people, millions of people were told was the most important event in human history, far more important than the birth of Jesus Christ, with which it was compared. You may recall Manning Clark actually compared Vladimir Lenin, not John Lennon, to Jesus Christ, you know, and I think he later regretted that. But I mean, that was the point, that, you know, for 70 years, this was the most important event in human history. Now it's not even important enough to actually to commemorate. And look, in that regard, the commemoration of the centenary of the setting up of the Cheka.
No, Cheka, which is it?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Cheka, which became the NKVD, which was, of course, Stalin's instrument for the Great Terror.
Which became the KGB.
Which became the FSB. And, you know, so these two really are closely interlinked. And the commemoration of the Cheka, I think, can't be separated from the way that history is being rewritten quite radically in Russia. You know, there's a Russian saying that Russia is the land of miracles and the unpredictable past. And the way the revolution is being presented now, let me just quote you something which was said to the Russian Parliament last year by a prominent member of the Australian Russian community. He addressed the Russian Parliament, and he said the following, if you'll bear with me. "I wish to draw your attention to the fact that in 1917 and again in 1991, Russia was the target of two covert operations mounted by the intelligence services of the Western powers. The first Russian revolution, that's the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks, was carried out by German intelligence services, who dispatched Lenin to Russia. The second, in 1991, was mounted by the American CIA to destroy the Soviet Union." So, in other words, the presentation of the Russian Revolution and the celebration of the FSB, the Cheka, as the guardian, you know, of Russian sovereignty, the defender of Russia, these two things, it seems to me, are closely interlinked. Now, with the Cheka, it's very interesting, the head of the FSB, Mr. Baratnikov, the day before the centenary, which is, by the way, is a national holiday. It's called the National Day for Workers in the Secret Services. He gave a press interview.
Is this true?
Yes, National Holiday for Workers in the Secret Services. By the way, the 23rd of December is the National Holiday for Workers in Long Range Aviation. It's true. They like centenaries. So he gave this interview in which, in effect, he whitewashed the Great Terror. He said that of this, the figures vary, 640,000 to 760,000 people shot in the back of the neck, back of the head. That's not counting the people who went to the gulag. He said, well, look, many of these people actually were traitors or spies or corrupt. Now, this prompted a very angry letter from 32 members of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who pointed out that really the constellation of Russian science also fell victim to the Great Terror. And the final point would be that by whitewashing the Great Terror, it's all part of the rehabilitation of Stalin. And that's what we've seen under Putin since about 2012. Stalin is now presented as the greatest figure in human history in Russian school textbooks. The second greatest figure in human history is Vladimir Putin. And so the scientists from the Academy of Science said, look, this is outrageous, this rewriting of history. And what's more, it's very worrying because it begins to look like us, like a slippery slope, and we urge fellow citizens to be vigilant. Now, I suppose you could say this just shows how different Russia is from China. Because if 30 Chinese scientists said something similar about the presentation of, say, the Great Leap Forward or the Great Famine, well, I suspect, you know, they would be very soon out of their jobs.
Well, I mean, it's just interesting hearing what you said earlier, Anthony, about MBS's challenge to make that society a different society. I mean, you come up hard against people defending a past, don't you? And you've got to work out where you sit in that respect.
The one advantage that MBS has in the Middle East, and he's 30-something, is that most Saudis are under the age of 30. Mm. So there are important pockets of resistance, but there are people that are in Saudis, young Saudis, that are cheering him on. The more interesting comparison for me is that people like MBS in the Middle East see Putin as a bit of a role model in the way that he's kind of centralized power. They like him. The Crown Prince in the UAE, you know, similarly a modernizer of his country, but also a big Putin fan. So there's that sense of gather up all the controls and centralized power, and then you know, transform your country along the lines you want to.
Which I suppose Kim Jong-un is also doing, Lauren, or that's what he would, well, in fact, he and his father and grandfather would have said the same thing. So it's this identity politics thing, isn't it, too?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in the context of Northeast Asia, the region I specialise in, history and remembrance has always been very much tied to politics. And governments will remember particular things in a certain way when it's in their political interest to do so, to stir up nationalism, etc.
I want to finish with my nomination, which is the anniversary of Woodrow Wilson giving his 14-point statement, a very ambitious, idealistic statement. It was on the 8th of January, 1918, which effectively set out the principles for peace and the establishment further down the line for the United Nations. Now, there was some audio of Wilson speaking, but as you can imagine, the quality wasn't quite good enough to play 100 years later. But it was an effort to reshape the global order at the time, Anthony. It seems a long... Well, does it seem a long way from what we're discussing at the moment? I mean, it's much more of a realist foreign policy, I suppose, allegedly re-entering the picture now, where nations look at their own self-interest, and especially if we're moving out from under the US hegemony. Is there room for this sort of idealism? Because I tell you what, it's fabulous to read again.
I hope there is. I fear there isn't. There is no question that the order, the global order, that the global rules-based order that we came to understand and benefit from after World War II is changing. People like Putin, the kind of Chinese leadership, others are trying to change it. President Trump, unfortunately, doesn't seem to be that interested in it. So I fear that the kind of order that is emerging will be very far from the 14 points that he outlined.
Yeah, because Carl Wilson, what he actually said was that he wanted a world, this is at the end of the shocking World War One, that sort of charnel house, he wanted a world to be made fit and safe to live in. He didn't want war as a means of national self-advancement. Do you fear we're heading back more towards that or not?
I can only agree with Anthony. You know, it's as you say, it's almost inspiring to read that idealism, you know, in geopolitics, you know, a serious attempt to lay the basis for peace in Europe, to prevent another war between France and Germany. We know that his ideas were disfigured and traduced at the Versailles Conference, you know, by Clemenceau and Lloyd George. Look around the world today for some idealism. Where will you find it? Perhaps in the Nordic countries? perhaps in Canada, perhaps a little in Australia. You won't find it in the Oval Office, and you won't find it in the Kremlin. I don't think you'll find it in Zhongnanhai in Beijing. Because, you know, clearly, as Anthony was saying, both China and Russia are actually seeking to change and undo the global order. It would appear on the basis of 19th century spheres of influence. They're really not about a rules-based order. They claim they had nothing to do with writing the rules. But, I mean, given, you know, the problems we face, we've mentioned none of them today, but, you know, if you think about demography, pollution, what's happening to the environment, water degradation, epidemics, you know, the colossal problems, and they absolutely obviously require a multilateral approach. And so, you know, it seems to me that it's only a matter of time before some kind of Wilsonian idealism is forced on us, you know, for reasons of self, of sort of survival and pragmatism, self-interest.
Maybe we just hope it's not after a conflagration. You know, in other words, I presume it's maybe it's only crisis that forces that break away from what appears to be easier, which is national self-interest, Lauren. It you know, I'm breaking it down into very simple things, but it seems more straightforward to actually step out and make the neighbourhood work better. Takes a lot of effort, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we could maybe even look at Wilson's legacy in relation to the two issues that I discussed today. I mean, he really helped to his ideals really helped to transform US foreign policy during the 20th century from a focus on isolationist policies to internationalization. And I think the very fact that the US is involved in this Korean conflict today with North Korea really stems, you know, from that internationalization of US foreign policy and the collective security ideals, too. We can see in the US alliances with South Korea and Japan that are still crucial to managing the region today.
Yes, I'm hoping we can look at the Japanese and the Chinese together over many, several centuries and what that's been like to try to manage that. Look, thank you all very much indeed to kick us off. Kyle Wilson, Anthony Bubalo and Lauren Richardson, I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Pleasure.
And Kyle Wilson is the visiting fellow at the Centre for European Studies at the ANU, where Lauren Richardson also resides. She's Director of Studies there at the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy. And Anthony Bubalo is now a principal at the Naus Consultancy Group.